little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Bob. Today we are going to be talking about an overview of the role of logic in acquiring knowledge and forming beliefs, the most important aspects of logic for critical thinkers to master, what can be done to encourage better practices in our thinking, communication, and belief formation, using logic to navigate issues which relate to values, and a variety of other topics.
And with what I consider to be the gold standard foundational education, that is a bachelor's degree in mathematics with a second major in philosophy and a minor in physics, that's about as foundational as you can get, our guest, Patrick Hurley, followed the philosophy muse then to complete a PhD at St. Louis University in philosophy of science with an emphasis in history of philosophy. And in 1972, then Patrick began his long academic career at the University of San Diego, where he taught classes in logic, philosophy of science, metaphysics, process philosophy, and legal ethics, while also finding time to become a USD student himself, earning a law degree, and being admitted to the California Bar Association. During his early years at USD, he wrote and published his widely acclaimed textbook called A Concise Introduction to Logic. And it's that book that brings him here to Thinking Clearly. That textbook, which I think I got from you, Julia, is now in its 14th edition, is by far my favorite book on logic because of its breadth, its clarity, its abundance of examples and exercises designed to teach readers how to analyze and construct logical arguments about real life issues. And in addition to being a superlative text for logic classes, I believe it can serve well as a text or self-study book. I consider it mandatory for people who are serious about understanding and practicing critical thinking. And although Patrick retired from USD back in 2008, he didn't stop thinking deeply about important issues. And in 2022, his book, Religion, Power, and Illusion, A Genealogy of Religious Belief, was released. Patrick Hurley, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Julia, for having me on your show.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. As Bob had mentioned, you haven't had an early interest in foundational fields like mathematics, physics, and philosophy. Could you tell us a little bit more about like what influences guided your educational and career path toward philosophy, logic, and law?
Yeah, let me talk a little bit first about context or backdrop. Education today is really different from the way it was when I went to high school and college a long time ago. Today, education has become highly commercialized, I think. Everything seems to be aimed at getting a job. When you get that job, get one that earns the best salary that you can. But when I went to school, that connection with a job was unheard of. You didn't go to school to get a job. You went to school to learn things that was important. And what was important? Well, what was important was developing your mental abilities and expanding your mental vision. After all, that's what makes us human, is we have minds, which are somewhat different from what animals have. So developing your mental abilities was something that made you more human. So becoming human in the fullest extent, that's why we went to school. So when I was in high school, we studied such subjects as Latin and Greek and mathematics, physics, chemistry, biology. We read almost all the plays of Shakespeare by the time I finished. We memorized hundreds or thousands of lines of poetry. In mathematics, one of the courses that we studied was analytic geometry, which absolutely fascinated me. When you take figures that are called conic sections, these are sections of a cone. If you cut a cone with a plane, you get a circle or an ellipse or a parabola. And learning how those figures could be represented and actually defined in terms of algebraic equations. That just blew my mind. Of course, analytic geometry, if anybody knows anything about it, was invented by Descartes, René Descartes in the 17th century. And when he accomplished that, what he did was he succeeded in unifying two branches of mathematics, which had been separate up until that point, namely algebra and geometry. And I just found that that was extraordinary. So that's what captured my interest in mathematics to start with. So when I got to college, it was largely more of the same. Actually, I found that going to college was easier than going to high school because our classes were pretty rigorous in high school. When we memorized poetry, we had to memorize it so the punctuation was included, and we had to be able to write it out in class. And if you missed a single comma or semicolon, you would be downgraded from an A to a B. That was pretty strict. So anyway, when we got to college, it was much of the same, more of the same: mathematics, philosophy, physics. And I was fascinated with philosophy because it answered, you know, tried to answer life's ultimate questions. I found that it really raised more questions than it answered, but at least it purported to give answers and to expand your vision. And physics and literature and stuff like that. When I got to grad school, I decided to focus on philosophy because I said I hoped that it would provide answers to the biggest questions, but it largely just opened more questions. But the questions that it opened were, what ultimately is real? And how do we know the real? So these are, in philosophy, are called metaphysics and epistemology. And as Bob noted, after I started teaching, I went to law school. I did that because to study law was free. I could do it free. And I didn't even have to leave campus. I could just walk across the street and go to a different school. So that's what I did. And why is law important? Well, law provides the foundations of society. So I'm always interested in foundational thinking. There's another philosopher that did the same thing in a major way, a 17th century figure by the name of Gottfried Wilhelm von Leibniz. Leibniz, one of the most important philosophers of the 17th century, got his Doctor of Law degree when he was 20 years old, and he was studying at a college that was so amazed, the University of Leipzig. They were so amazed that somebody could do this at age 20, they refused to give him the degree, so he switched to Hanover and presented a doctoral dissertation to Hanover. They immediately gave him his degree in law at age 20, doctor's degree in law. So he was an amazing guy, another philosopher that loved the law, and he used it for the purpose of diplomacy as he got older. So he didn't end up as a teacher. He ended up mainly as a diplomat, but he produces some of the most amazing work in philosophy that I've ever read. So anyway, in a nutshell, that's sort of my background in education, and it's taken me to where I am today.
Another feature of your book is that you do these little bios of various philosophers. I find those very, very interesting. And I'm glad that you mentioned something for our younger listeners to hear what a classical education was all about, a time before people worried about their career, getting a job, how to pay off their college loans. And so it was a different world in those days. So as an introduction to the subject of logic, I'm going to ask you four questions. And I'd like you to answer them as if you were giving explanations to an inquisitive, intelligent 12-year-old. So here's the questions. I'll give them to you all and then give you a chance to answer them. What is logic? How does logic really work? What makes it the best method of acquiring knowledge? And why should we pursue knowledge anyway?
In the simplest of terms, you might define logic as the science that evaluates and studies good reasoning. But the problem with that definition is that reasoning is something that goes on inside your head, so it's private. You can't see it. You can't hear it. Most logicians go with the definition that logic is the science or discipline that studies and evaluates arguments, and arguments are the way that reasoning is expressed. Well, logic is a public sort of a thing, while reasoning is a private sort of a thing. For example, if you want an example of an argument, if John went to the library, then he took his glasses. But let's suppose you know John and you look over on the counter and you see his glasses sitting there. So you conclude John didn't go to the library. If John went to the library, he took his glasses, but he didn't take his glasses. So John didn't go to the library. This is a famous argument form. The name of that form is called modus tollens. It's a Latin name. And what we have there is we have two statements that provide evidence or reasons for things. And then we have a statement that concludes from that evidence. The conclusion is John didn't go to the library. And that's the way every argument is set up. Every argument consists of at least one statement that sets forth evidence or reasons, and the third or fourth statement, whatever, sets forth what follows from that evidence or reasons. And the entire logic course, you know, is focused on those subjects, evidence for things and what follows from the evidence. And I know Thinking Clearly, the radio show, is heavily focused on the importance of evidence. And you won't find a subject where evidence plays a bigger role than logic. It's absolutely central to, you know, to the subject matter. As far as logic and knowledge, I think you might say that knowledge consists of facts together with reasons that support those facts and what those facts imply. So that's where logic comes in. Logic evaluates the reasons that support the facts, and it shows what follows from those facts. These are all expressed in arguments. So certainly logic is central to acquiring knowledge. There's a famous logician and philosopher. His name is W.K. Clifford. He's born in England and worked in England. And he's famous for the statement that it's wrong always, everywhere, and for everyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence. I might even repeat that. It's wrong always, everywhere, and for everyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence. I quote that statement right in the first page of my logic book. So if you want to look at it, you can look inside the book. Clifford was absolutely certain that, you know, that evidence is important for life, for living. And it's wrong, he says. You know, and I think he meant morally wrong. Well, why is it wrong to accept things on insufficient evidence? Well, because if our beliefs are not supported by evidence, they're disconnected from reality. And our beliefs are what lead us to do such things as vote. So if our voting is disconnected from reality, we're going to be voting for the wrong people and the wrong things. So I might say today the need for evidence to support claims is absolutely crucial. In this day and age, we have unsupported conspiracy theories that are going everywhere. Conspiracy theories by themselves, of course, are not a problem. There's a crime, you know, called criminal conspiracy. So if there weren't conspiracy theories, we wouldn't have that crime. But the problem occurs with conspiracy theories that are unsupported by evidence. That's where you run into problems. So that's one of the reasons why logic is so important today. We've gone crazy with these unsupported conspiracy theories. Logic, I might add, doesn't really tell us what constitutes evidence or good evidence. It just focuses on the need for evidence. If you want to find out what constitutes good evidence, take a series of courses in law. Good evidence is what would be admissible in a court of law. So I might also add that logic also studies the relationship between statements. It doesn't focus exclusively on arguments. Arguments are made up of statements. So logic also focuses on the relationship between statements. And two very important relationships, I might say, are the relationship of contradiction and statements that express tautologies. For example, if I give you this pair of statements that all cats are animals, but then I turn around and tell you, well, some cats are not animals, that's a contradiction. Or if I give you this statement, some circles are square, that's a self-contradiction, because by definition, circles are round and round things are not square. On the other hand, if I give you this pair of statements, it's either raining or it's not raining. That statement is called a tautology. It's necessarily true. It's always the case, obviously. It's either raining or not raining. On the other hand, contradictions are always false. So those are two kinds of statements that logic considers to be very important. And that, in a nutshell, is what logic talks about, Bob.
Yes, and you kind of anticipated a follow-up question that I was going to ask you. Is logic axiomatic? And I think you just cited, you know, a couple that qualify as axioms of logic. So are those considered non-contradiction, the law of the excluded middle, and identity law? Are those considered the axioms of logic?
Well, they would be in addition to logic, I think. In a sense, they lay outside the area of logic. They come more into the area of philosophy and also mathematics. Some mathematicians deny the law of excluded middle, interestingly enough. The law of excluded middle, incidentally, says that between two contradictory expressions, there is no middle ground. So no middle ground between two contradictory statements. And some philosophers of mathematics say that that's not the case. I'm not going to get into that. It's too complicated. Yeah. But another thing I might say in connection with logic and knowledge is what makes us fully human. We might say that lower animals, such as cats and dogs, have limited knowledge. Cats know how to find their way home. Dogs do the same thing. But only humans have knowledge in a broad sense. And I think logic is really required for acquiring knowledge in a broad sense.
And you did touch on why knowledge is important, is because using logic, and I would add critical thinking, it's the best way to get a good read on reality. Because a lot of people have realities that are altered realities. We'll talk a little bit about that later on. And I've made this point before on Thinking Clearly, is that it's in everyone's best interest. It's a survival skill to be able to accurately assess reality. Because if you can't accurately assess reality, then how are you going to really make decisions in your life about what to do if you don't have a good grasp on what is real and what is true?
Absolutely.
I grew up in a household with computers pretty much since I was young. I always considered computers kind of like a second language, if you will. And, you know, I've learned that computers function with built-in electronic hardware. Like one type would be a central processing unit or a CPU, which uses what's called logic gates and logical operations like and, or, not to process data. So I guess, you know, something I've reflected on in my life is, do human beings have some built-in logic functionality? Are we kind of born that way? Is it ingrained in us? Or is all of logic learned?
I think you're absolutely right that logic is kind of inborn in a certain way. And you can see this in the way that animals behave. Just to give an example. During the Middle Ages, the philosophers and logicians spoke oftenly about an argument called the dog argument. And it's connected with the way the dogs are used for hunting. And when hunters would take out a dog, they would want the dog to chase a rabbit, for example. The dog might be convinced that the rabbit either ran to the left or to the right. So the dog runs off to the left and sniffs around for a few seconds and finds there's no smell of any rabbits. So the dog will turn right around and go off to the right. Now, that's a fundamental kind of reasoning. And in logic, it's called disjunctive syllogism. The rabbit either ran to the left or it ran to the right. The dog finds it didn't go to the left, so it went to the right. This kind of argument is also found in children. When a child gets to be 2 or 3 years old, the child can develop that same kind of argument. In today's world, psychologists have proven that animals do know something about fundamental logic. They've conducted these experiments with baboons. You take a baboon and you put two pair of cups in front of the baboon, and you show the baboon something the baboon loves, a treat, such as a grape. Baboons love grapes. And you put it under one of the first pair of cups. You don't show the baboon which one it was. And you take another grape and you put it under one of the second pair of cups, but you don't show the baboon what it was. And then you show the first pair of cups to the baboon and let the baboon pick what cup hides the grape. And the baboon will pick one of the other. And if the baboon doesn't pick the right cup, nope, you pick up the cup, there's no grape. Baboon sees this got to be under the other cup. And how do you know that it's under the other cup? Well, the baboon might go to the other pair of cups. But the baboon will always stick with the first pair of cups. And if it's not under the first one, it will therefore pick the second one. And that's where the grape will be found. So humans do the same kind of thing. Is there something ingrained in the human DNA that paves the way for logic? It's very possible. But it certainly is the case that logic is intimately connected with ordinary living. And if that weren't the case, then we wouldn't find that logic is useful, and we do find it useful. We may not all become logicians in later life, but we use basic, simple kinds of logic every single day of our lives. So I think the answer, Julia, to your question is absolutely. Logic is built in some ways.
That gives me a lot of hope that we're going to be able to eventually get out of this epistemic crisis that I think we're in. We encourage people to use evidence and logic, which is in our definition for critical thinking. So for people striving to utilize critical thinking, evidence and logic to reason and to sample and test reality, I would guess that most of them, a lot of our listeners have not really taken a logic class. So for those self-learners who haven't either taken a logic class or a critical thinking course, what aspects or principles of logic are most important, do you think, to master in order to be an effective critical thinker?
There's really two basic kinds of logic. One of them is what's called class logic. And it relates to our tendencies to group things into classes. For example, you know, you might say that maples are certain kinds of trees. And there's a whole slew of arguments that are based in class logic. For example, you might say that all maples are trees, but all trees are living things, therefore all maples are living things, or something along those lines. Aristotle was the one who invented class logic. Aristotle lived back in his dates were 384 to 322 BC, so he's 2,300 years old now. And he developed this kind of logic to a high degree of sophistication. It's called syllogistic logic. His logic has to do with categorical syllogisms. Other forms of logic that relate to that involve circles, circle diagrams of all sorts. Venn diagrams are one kind of circle diagram, but more fundamental circle diagrams, you might draw one big circle and you might put a smaller circle inside of that and a smaller circle inside of that one. And each of those circles represent classes. If one circle is inside of a small circle, if that circle is inside of a bigger circle, and if that circle is inside of a bigger circle yet, well, then the first thing is inside of the biggest circle. That's a fundamental kind of reasoning. The second kind of logic I think that's really important was developed by a man by the name of Chrysippus, lived about 100 years after Aristotle. It's a kind of logic that's based on statements. For example, what if I was to give you this argument? I think I already gave it to you. If John went to the library, then he took his glasses, but he didn't take his glasses, then he didn't go to the library. That's called modus tollens. There's a whole bunch of arguments that are based on statements, in particular conditional statements that are like that. For example, if Napoleon was killed in a plane crash, then he's dead. Napoleon was not killed in a plane crash, therefore he's not dead. No, that would be a bad argument. And that argument commits a fallacy. It's called denying the antecedent. So for both kinds of logic, class logic, and a statement logic, I think it's important to learn the basic kinds of arguments that fall under those headings. The basic kinds of categorical syllogisms, all A are B, all B are C, therefore all A are C, for class logic. And for statement logic, the most basic forms of argument called modus tollens, modus ponens, disjunctive syllogism, that's the kind of argument they tried on the monkeys and the dogs, and constructive dilemma. Those are fundamental kinds of argument forms in class logic. So, and in addition to these basic forms of argument, it's important to know something about the fallacious forms, the fallacies, for both class logic and statement logic. A famous fallacy under class logic is called undistributed middle. For example, if I was to give you this argument, all cats are animals, all cats are mammals, therefore all mammals are animals. All three statements are true, but the reasoning is not any good. It commits a fallacy. It's called undistributed middle. And in statement logic, the argument that I gave you about Napoleon, if Napoleon was killed in a plane crash, then he's dead. He wasn't killed in a plane crash. That's called affirming the consonant. There's another kind of famous fallacy called denying the antecedent. So becoming familiar with those fallacies is really important. That's what I would say. Everyone, if you want to have a very basic kind of knowledge of logic, you should look into those areas.
Yeah, and that's the first few chapters of your book.
Yes, they are.
And I'm glad you mentioned Venn diagrams, because logic can be, and language itself can be pretty abstract. And whenever we're trying to learn something, if we can get it back to something that's concrete, something that we can see, like a Venn diagram, you can see one being enclosed by another, it really clears it up and gives it much more of an intuitive feeling. So I do use Venn diagrams when I get confused about the language that's involved. It can get pretty convoluted language by itself. So it's good to have these kinds of things like Venn diagrams. Glad you got into that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. If you can see something, you know, it's very easy usually to understand it.
As we were talking about before the show, I had the pleasure of being a student teacher utilizing your textbook. And I imagine you've interfaced with a few students in your day. Throughout your career, I'm kind of curious, you know, the experience from the teacher's perspective can be very different from the student's perspective. So I'm kind of curious, throughout your career, which topics you found to be the most challenging for students to learn and master?
Well, at the beginning of every class, I would have my students go out into the real world, look in magazines, newspapers, letters to the editor, that sort of a thing, and find an example of an argument and identify the premises and the conclusion, of course. And I would have the students Xerox it for me or write it out or somebody hand it in. And I would always look to see what they did. And some of the brighter students were really good. You know, letters to the editor are good sources of arguments. And the students who looked in letters to the editor would often be able to find good examples. But some students, you know, would come up with stuff that didn't resemble an argument. You know, for example, that they would come to me with a description or a warning or a piece of advice or something. Those are not arguments. So it was a bit of a hurdle, you know, for the students to get a clear idea of what constitutes an argument and being able to find one. And closely related to that, I would have the students write me a short little paragraph using what are called indicator words, premise and conclusion indicator words, words like therefore, hence, so, thus, for, because, on account of. These words are used very closely in connection with arguments. So I'd have the student use some of those words and construct a paragraph and make sure those words, those indicator words, were used for the purpose of creating an argument. Well, the good students could always do that, but sometimes students would use words like therefore, hence, and so, in a way totally unconnected with arguments. So that was another hurdle, I think, that the students had to get over. Later on, I think some students found it difficult in producing proof sequences. These are the same sort of things that everybody's familiar with who has taken a course in geometry. You will start with a certain set of axioms, and then you would figure out, you know, what kind of propositions could follow from those axioms. Like many propositions would relate to triangles, the side opposite. The 30-degree angle of a right triangle is one half the hypotenuse, and that sort of thing. It's very easy to prove that, but you would need a series of statements in order to do it. And logic depends heavily on proving conclusions, and you use series of statements to do that. Some students never did get the idea, you know, but most of them with practice would learn how to do it, especially if they had taken a course in geometry. So those are the challenging areas, initially challenging for students, I think.
Those courses in geometry are becoming more rare. Geometry was always a part of classical education. I remember geometry. I did better in algebra than geometry because those proofs are challenging. That is difficult to get the idea of thinking in terms of proofs and how can I actually prove this. But it does exercise the mind. And I'm sorry to say that some high schools have eliminated geometry from the curriculum. And that is unfortunate, I think. But presently, you talked a little bit about epistemic crisis in America. I look at it as if we are in an epistemic crisis. And we've talked a lot about that on Thinking Clearly, especially in the political arena, where the model just seems to be truth doesn't matter. Truth doesn't matter. And using information and misinformation as a weapon is actually encouraged. And people seem willing to embrace any alternate reality, not caring what is actually true, as long as it works to advance their agenda. So I'm interested in what your thoughts are on that and how you would rate our epistemic health now in the U.S., say, relative to when you started teaching at USD back in 1972, and what can be done to encourage better practices in our thinking, communication, and belief formation.
Well, Bob, I think you're absolutely right that we are in an epistemic crisis right now. I don't know when it began. Maybe we had the beginnings of it when I first started teaching at USD. My God, that was 50 years ago. But we're certainly in one now. Oh, my God. You look at what's happening with alternate realities, alternate truths, alternate facts. This is absolutely absurd. And how did we get into this mess, I've asked myself? Well, there's a lot of things. Our curriculum in the schools are deteriorating. I hadn't known that some high schools don't teach geometry anymore. That's unbelievable, because geometry was one of the original seven liberal arts, you know, part of the quadrivium: arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, music. Maybe they won't teach arithmetic anymore in the years to come. That would be hard to believe. But anyway, what got us into this mess? And there's a lot of reasons, I think. But one of them, I think, people are led to believe that there is a book out there somewhere that has all the answers to things. What is that book? Well, it might be the Bible. It might be the Torah in Judaism, or it might be the Quran in Islam. Many people who are brought up in fundamental versions of these religious beliefs think that any question you have can be found by looking into this book. Whitehead, the philosopher, whom I've studied quite a bit, said that this is one instance of the fallacy of the perfect dictionary, that there is some dictionary out there that gives the perfect definition of absolutely every word. Well, there isn't. And there's no book, I don't care, you know, what you call it, there's no book that has the answer to everything. But going from that frame of mind, you know, that there is some easy place to look where you'll get all the answers, to this, they replace the book with a person. And they say that there is some person who has all the answers. This is worse, okay? This person becomes a cult leader or some kind of a guru, perhaps a personality figure of some sort. And all you have to do is listen to what this person says, and you'll have all the answers. They're all the answers that you want. And some people, believe it or not, maybe it's not believe it or not, they turn to Donald Trump, think that he has all the answers to things, and anything that he says is absolutely true. This is unbelievable, you know, because he doesn't have the answers, and he doesn't even tell the truth half the time, or maybe most of the time. Let me add this. Finding the truth is hard work, okay?
Yes.
And during, this became really important, you know, with the advent of science in the Renaissance, and it started out with astronomy was one of the first sciences. And some of the believers, the true believers during the Middle Ages, said that you wouldn't dare look in a telescope because the telescope was the product of demons and you would find a false reality in the telescope. It took Galileo, you know, years to prove that telescopes were not something evil, the product of Satan. So finding the truth about things is hard work. And if you think that all you have to do is listen to some kind of a cult leader, you're deluding yourself. That's an illusion. But it's easy. That's the reason why they do it. It's what lazy people do. It's the lazy man's way, or lazy woman's way, of finding out what they think is the truth about things. You just lay back and listen to the cult leader. No, that's not going to give you the truth. So what is the fix here? One of the fixes is to get back to subject matters where truth counts, you know, where there's a difference between truth and falsity. You know, you can have your students stand up in front of the class and describe, you know, what their feelings are about something. And they'll be happy to do that. But there is a big difference between having feelings about something and knowing the truth about it. So what should they study? Well, of course, I would say it'd be great to have them study logic, because truth and falsehood are absolutely central to logic. Mathematics as well. Truth is absolutely central to mathematics. Either you, in the end, have proved the theorem or you haven't proved it, you know. And if you've proved it, the theorem is true based upon the axioms. The natural sciences, especially those that depend upon mathematics, you know, like physics and chemistry. Bob, I know you study chemistry. Even the sciences that don't depend heavily on mathematics. Another one would be astronomy, incidentally. But even sciences that don't depend heavily on mathematics are really important to study, because there is a truth and there is a falsity and there are theories, and either we succeed in confirming the theories or we don't, you know. And if the theories are confirmed, they're tentatively held to be true now. They're going to be held to be true until something better comes along, or until some evidence turns up that tells us, you know, that maybe the theory is not correct. So in science, theories are held to be true in a tentative sense of the term. They're not absolutely true, like the pronouncements, you know, that come from the guru or the cult leader. Nothing in science is absolutely true, but it's absolutely the best thing that we have today now. So that's why studying the sciences, I think, is really important. In sciences, there's a focus on experiment. Experiment provides evidence, provides us with what we need to confirm the theories. And it's the great success, you know, of the last 500 or 600 years of thinking. Science is something that came out of philosophy. Physics, of course, was a book that Aristotle wrote way back 2,300 years ago. Philosophy is where science came from. And the difference between science and philosophy, philosophy focuses on reality across the board in general. Science focuses on the measurable part of reality. So they both are extremely important, I think, in focusing on the need for truth and concentrating on truth. There are not alternate realities, I would say. Would you agree, Bob? I hope you would.
I certainly agree with that. When you say it's hard work, it is hard work. Mm-hmm. Critical thinking is hard work. And what I struggle with is, how can we convince people that that hard work is really worth it, rather than either just throwing up your hands and saying, everybody tells me something different and I don't know what to believe. So like you said, just believe what some cult leader or some political leader or some religious leader says and accept their reality. One of the arguments that I use is that one of the important things about knowledge is to do the hard work to make it your own. You have earned the ability to have that knowledge because you've thought it through. You've collected evidence. You've tested reality. One of the things that I think that distances science from people is because science becomes so detailed and specialized, it's almost insurmountable by people. That's why I respect people who write popular science books, journalists who are science writers, who try to bring it down to earth so that people can actually understand it, not maybe in the detailed mathematical way that some physicist would understand it, but to get the gist of it, to understand it enough and appreciate it as a view to reality.
Yes, absolutely.
On Thinking Clearly, we've talked a number of times about the difference between arguments making descriptive claims versus those making normative claims. How is it best to proceed when the argument is largely a normative or value-based argument, as is the case with most political issues, which I think a number of us are talking about these days, for example, reparations or abortion? How is it best to proceed with those arguments?
You might proceed in kind of a rhetorical fashion. Rhetoric, of course, is the science science of persuasion. You might say that the best arguments are those that persuade people. And since you're on the subject of abortion, you might say, well, what arguments are the best ones to persuade people about the rightness or wrongness of abortion? Many people say that abortion is wrong because it's a form of murder. You know, and there's a logic to this, if you like. Why is it a form of murder? Well, because it involves killing a human being. Well, what's a human being? Well, a human being is something that has a soul. Well, so then do fetuses, do embryos, do they have souls? Well, this gets us back to, well, when is the soul infused? And here's where we get all kinds of answers. If you listen to religious figures, and I don't want to appear as being anti-religious here, but if you listen to religious figures, you're going to get answers all over the place. For example, Christians, many of them, probably most of them, will say that that the soul is infused at conception. So at the moment when the sperm hits the egg, human conception, that's when the soul is infused. But oddly enough, the greatest Christian theologian, I would say, is Thomas Aquinas. He disagreed with that. He said that he went along with Aristotle. He was very heavily influenced by Aristotle. And he said that the souls of male babies were infused at 40 days and the souls of female babies were infused at 90 days. So he had a distinction there. Why he distinguished between boys and girls, I think, goes back to a kind of a sexism that we found we find in philosophy. So that's what we have for Christians. What about Jews? Well, many Jews, perhaps most, will say that the soul is infused at first breath, when the baby's first born. So abortion would be perfectly acceptable, you know, for some Jews, maybe right up until birth. That might be horrifying to some people, but there is a certain logic to that, too. And what about Muslims? Well, Muslims are kind of all over the place. Some say at conception, some say at 40 days, which is the time of fetal heartbeat. Some say at 120 days, which is about the time of quickening. The problem is, if you look to religion for an answer about some of these normative arguments, you're going to get arguments, you're going to get opinions from all over the place, and you're not going to have any answers. Well, if you turn away from religion, what about the government? You think the government knows when the soul is infused? No, they're probably going to be less expert than the religious figures. Well, what about a judge? Well, the most famous judge in this case is Justice Blackmun, who wrote Roe v. Wade. And he took kind of a Socratic approach to the whole thing. He broke the whole question of abortion up into three trimesters. The first trimester, the mother-to-be pretty much decided for herself. During the second trimester, another set of reasons came into play. And in the third trimester, it's only under special circumstances that abortion would be allowed. That's not a too bad of approach, but Roe v. Wade has now been declared not the law by the Supreme Court. It was kind of shocking to me. I thought it would never happen. It was in effect for 50 years, and then it was decided not to be the case. The last possibility, if you don't want to go with a judge, well, what about the mother-to-be? Maybe the pregnant woman herself, in consultation with the spouse and friends and others and counselors, should be the best person to ask in connection with abortion. So I think those are the kinds of issues that you might want to look at. You know, who is best to judge? Religious figures, government figures, judges, the pregnant woman. I think that's maybe the best way of looking at it. And I'm inclined to think, after all the dust settles, that maybe you should ask, within certain limits, whether the pregnant woman herself should not be able to make the final decision.
And you've left one category out. What about atheists who don't believe in a soul? How do we deal with the argument at that point?
Well, you know, I think most people would want to say that when the baby's born, it's going to be a human being for most people. You know, it looks like a human being, functions like a human being in many ways. It may not write geometry books yet, but still there are so many features, human features, that it has. So you would have to stick, I think, with the moment of birth, as far as atheists go, but you might want to put it a little earlier too. It's a becoming process. You know, humans just don't pop up fully made, in a moment. I think of that famous painting by Botticelli, where Venus is stepping out of a clamshell, and she's beautiful and has gorgeous hair, and probably speaks a flawless Greek and that sort of thing. That's not the way humans come upon the scene. It's a developmental process, and humans do develop at some point in time. They become human. We're going to have to decide when that is, I think. That's the thing with atheists. We're going to have to say, okay, when do you think it happens? I don't think we're going to allow ourselves to kill human beings. So burden of proof is on them.
And getting back to religion now, I have a question. The schools where you both got your undergraduate and graduate education, at Gonzaga University and St. Louis University, they're associated with the Jesuit Catholic tradition. And the university where you taught for all those years, University of San Diego, is rooted in the Roman Catholic tradition. But then after you retired in 2008, you wrote a book that was called Religion, Power, and Illusion, A Genealogy of Religious Beliefs. And I read the Kirkus Review. I didn't read that book, but I read the Kirkus Review of it. And the headline of Kirkus Reviews goes like this. It says it's, quote, a sharply provocative, often engrossing challenge to faith-based pieties. Help us understand how that book came to be.
By reputation, the Jesuits are excellent educators, and I think I probably would go along with that. I think I would consider myself very much a product of the Jesuits, but sometimes the product doesn't turn out the way the producer thinks it's going to turn out. So I think maybe that's the case with me. But they did, the Jesuits did give me all the tools I would need to produce a critique of both religion and religious beliefs in God. So that's what I did in that book. I simply used the tools the Jesuits gave me, philosophy and logic, a critical frame of mind, looking for evidence to support our beliefs. And what I came up with was that book. I don't know, the first doubts that I may have had about religion probably occurred when I was a teenager. Teenagers think about sex a lot. And one of the things that the church taught when I was a kid was that if you dwell on thoughts about sex, you might commit a mortal sin, and mortal sins will send you to hell. Of course, that scared the hell out of me at first, but after a while, I gave a little thought to it. It seemed to me that it was a bit extreme. And also, the church said at that time that divorce was not allowed. If you got married, you could get a divorce, but you couldn't remarry. Now, that to me seemed a bit weird because people change, you know, during a course of marriage, and sometimes they just grow apart. So those were a couple of things that kind of separated me off from the Catholic Church. By the time I reached adulthood, I was pretty much a fringe Catholic, but thinking along these lines drove me even further away. When we think about the Christian God, for example, the Christian God is made up of three entities, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Originally, as I began to dig into this, I found that the Christian God was really a family. There was a father, obviously, that's named. But unbelievably, there was a mother who was the Holy Spirit, and the two of them then gave birth to Jesus, to the Son, you know, who became Jesus in its human form. And this sort of made sense to people, you know, years and years ago, 2,000 years ago, and it was highly attractive, I think, to Christian converts. But when the bishops got hold of this idea, they started wondering, well, what is Father? What is Son? What is Holy Spirit? And they're supposed to be all gods. And yet Christianity is supposed to be a monotheistic religion. So how can these three things, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, all be gods and yet have one God? This seems to me to be an outright contradiction. And I think today it absolutely is a contradiction. And I've looked into it really deeply. So that's a problem. And when the foundational belief of your religion is a contradiction, that really leads you to wonder. The greatest church theologians, Augustine and Aquinas, both held that you could not understand the Holy Trinity in this life, but you would only be able to see it in the next life. In this life, it's a mystery. But what's going on here? You have a contradiction and you smooth it over by calling it a mystery? No, anytime you reach a contradiction, that's a dead end, and then you get around it by calling it a mystery. No, that's not going to work. So these are some of the things that have gone into my religious upbringing. The last nail on the coffin was a trip to Egypt that I took a few years ago, and I found an amazing similarity between Egyptian religion and Christianity. In Egyptian religion, you had priests, you had rituals conducted by priests, you had festivals that were used to solidify the ancient Egyptians' belief. You had gods, you had temples, you had an afterlife. All of these things you found in Christianity. And I said, my goodness, could this be the beginning of a religion? I spent 10 years looking into this. And that's what led to the book, Religion, Power, and Illusion. The conclusion of the book is that religious beliefs are illusions. They're created by priests for the purpose of augmenting priestly power. So the foundation of and the source of religion is power, human power. And that might be horrendous. A lot of your listeners are curious. You might look into that book.
Bob and I, here on Thinking Clearly, we like to keep it real. We might talk about all this critical thinking and logic and how to do it best, but we're also imperfect people who are doing our best. In your own real-life discussions and non-professional analysis and thinking about issues, I'm curious, what are some of the biggest violations of logical principles that you catch yourself doing?
Believe it or not, I have a wife who studied philosophy, and she's the one who catches me doing these things, and she's usually right. One of them is false dichotomy. For example, when we're going to the airport, she really likes to get there early, you know, more than 2 hours before departure. And I like to shave it, you know, a little bit because I hate sitting in airports doing nothing. So what does I say? Okay, you want to get to the airport 2 or 3 hours early. Well, why not 5 hours or why not 10 hours early? You know, in fact, we could spend the whole night in the airport if you want. You know, that is a case of false dichotomy, as if there's no middle ground between getting there an hour and a half early and getting there 5 hours early. False dichotomy, no middle ground. Of course, there's a middle ground. Another one is called hasty generalization. If my wife buys something on Amazon and I think is useless and we end up not using it at all, so then I say, well, why are you always buying these things that are useless? Why do you do this all the time? Well, that's hasty generalization. So she happens to buy one thing that doesn't have a use. So I conclude that all of the things that she buys doesn't have a use. This is pretty common, I think, among married couples. Why do you do this all the time? Almost all the time, that's a failure in logic, and it's called a hasty generalization.
I'm still laughing. I'm just imagining there should be like a comic book of the married philosophers or something. Yeah. It'd be like a Seinfeld or something. For myself, I look outside my front window and I see a broken down second car. And I would have to say it's the sunk cost fallacy. It doesn't get me super often, but I can really catch myself. And I started this project. I've already put this much money into it. I've already put this much time into it. I can't give up now. So if anyone wants a 2009 Forester for parts, just let me know. How about you, Bob?
I'd say cherry picking, and I think that's what Patrick in his book called suppressed evidence. Even though I say oftentimes I'm going to look for the opposite of what I really believe, I will look for those things and sometimes dismissing the things that are good arguments for the opposite. And the other would be an ad hominem informal fallacy, trying to infer someone's motivations. That's a big one. I guess it's because trust is a big issue with me. We were talking about President Trump and how he plays loosely with the truth. We had a guest last month, Bill Adair, who talked about the president being the biggest liar that we've ever had as a president. And yeah, I think that's pretty obvious. And so I began to infer President Trump's motivations and seeing every motivation as trying to garner power, trying to make himself always the winner in the big cheese. And I believe those are his motivations. Maybe he has other motivations. Who knows? I don't know him personally, but that's a big one with me. I infer people's motivations, and inferring people's motivations is not really an argument. We don't know what people's motivations is. First, we don't have a lot of evidence as to what their motivations are. We have a lot of evidence of what they're doing, but their actual motivations, pretty shaky evidence in most cases.
And I bet you're not thinking about people's motivations of that which you cherry pick from.
Exactly. So we all are guilty of that stuff. I remember a podcast with Daniel Kahneman, who did a lot of work, and we've talked about the dual systems theory, fast thinking and slow thinking. Daniel Kahneman point blank made the statement, as much of an expert as I am and as much as I've studied the biases that we have that come from our heuristics, I still am guilty of doing them. I catch myself doing them. Well, if Daniel Kahneman can say that about heuristics and biases, I think we can all say that about fallacies in logic.
Yeah. And you want to talk about Donald Trump and fallacies?
We don't have that much time left in the show.
We do not have that much time. We're just about out of time. But I do want to ask you, in terms of what we've talked about, the use of logic for critical thinking, how important that is, do you have any last words that might benefit our listeners?
Sure. One of the fallacies that's really important is unqualified authority, appeal to unqualified authority. We have to depend on authorities in our life. We just cannot be experts in everything. When we get sick, we go to the doctor. Why? Because the doctor is an authority. When we're curious about some subject, we like a subject in law, we ask a lawyer, because the lawyer is an authority. We have to depend upon authorities. Let's be certain that the authorities that we depend on are genuine authorities. What's a genuine authority? Went to school, perhaps, you know, and studied subjects, you know, that require some degree of expertise. And when voters go to the voting booth, they depend upon authorities that are horrible, some media personality or something. These people are usually not authorities. So dig a little deeper, people, and make sure that the authorities that you depend upon are genuine authorities.
Thank you for those last words of wisdom to sum up what we've been talking about on this episode of Thinking Clearly. So, Patrick Hurley, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your experience with us, and especially for writing and keeping updated that precious book called A Concise Introduction to Logic, which I'm going to say is mandatory for any serious student of critical thinking. And on the back of the cover of the 11th edition, which I have and I inherited from Julia, it says this: the gold standard for today's introduction to logic, providing carefully sequenced exercises, precise explanations, elegant solutions, and clear examples to help students become more logical and effective thinkers, end quote. I heartily endorse that description. So on our Facebook page, we're going to post links to your books, both of them, and to your author page at patrickhurleyauthor.com. You spell Hurley, H-U-R-L-E-Y. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post, Patrick?
No, that definitely takes care of it, Bob. And thank you very much, Bob and Julia, for having me on your show.
I do want to give a shout out to our listeners. Thank you for your support. And as always, Julia, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.